Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 100. We are at the centennial minute, of Season 5 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is my good friend, Alan Sanders, fully of the Wilder Ride, and hopefully, you know, at some point he'll get that back going, but he's also got the Alan Sanders Show going at the same time. So, you know, we got some good stuff coming from Alan. So welcome back to the show, Alan, for the 100th episode of this season.
It feels like I've reached a milestone with you. So I'm very pleased to be with you as we wrap up this week.
Yeah, seriously. And what a week it's been. You know, we had the, you know, throat slashed, people getting shot at point blank range. You know, fun things that you can only get in a Die Hard movie. So,
right. This is the week we both get our, the audience got the rug pulled out from under us, not once, but twice with gotchas.
That's right. Gotchas are great. Did you ever see that movie Gotcha with Anthony Edwards?
Yes.
I loved that as a kid.
Angled with a spy or something. And it started off as like the assassin game you play.
I actually
in high school played that with some friends. We did that for about 5 or 6 months in and around when that movie came out, and it was a lot of fun. I never made it to – I always got whacked usually in rounds 1 or 2.
Oh, wow.
So it came – I am terribly unobservant.
Yeah, it came out in 85, and I remember seeing that on cable so many times. You know, it's a fun movie. I've rewatched it since. It's not as good, but it's still fun because, you know, you still have the memories from you know, when you saw it as a kid and enjoyed it, that type of thing.
Yeah. Sometimes the nostalgia of a movie lets you see past the blemishes, but then sometimes you go back and wish that you'd never ruined the memory you had in your head of the movie. Sometimes you go back and go, oh, it was so much better in my head.
Yes, I've been there. I think most people have been there. So it makes sense. You know, it's one of those things that there are tons of movies that I loved as a kid. Then when I rewatched them as an adult, I can't believe that I enjoyed them. And then I have others that I continue to enjoy them partially because of the fact that I saw them when I was a kid. So, yeah, you know, exactly. you get it both ways there. So, and Gotcha is definitely on that list. Die Hard 2 is sort of on that list, I guess you could say, for me, because I enjoyed it so much when I first saw it. So, you know, who knows? So minute 100 begins with the S of
Oops. Really?
Yes, really.
Well, you may have seen a different movie than I saw.
Apparently. So minute 100 begins with the mass exodus continuing and ends with a Merry Christmas from Vito. Yesterday, we ended things with, you know, Thornburg giving his whole diatribe on TV and starting to cause a ruckus in the airport with all the who we're not really sure whether these are passengers or whether these are people waiting for other people, the planes to get in, or just people who like loitering around in the airport, you know, at 10, 11 o'clock at night. Who knows? Could be anything. Right. And, you know, they start basically, I don't know if you want to call it a riot, but people are just trying to get out of there as quickly as possible. Because now they've all realized.
I'd call it more of a stampede, that panic exit stampede style of chaos.
Okay, that makes sense too. You know, I would call that so stampede of chaos. Okay, yeah, I guess I can go with that one.
Because they're not damaging intentionally; they're all trying to escape. It's just in mass panic, things actually, you know, get knocked over, and then people start to fall, and then. That's where people end up getting crushed because you're not paying attention. And the whole herd, like a stampede, is just moving because it's not thinking. It's just moving in one direction.
Right. And that's true. It's basically, as we talked about yesterday, it's every man for himself. You know, it doesn't matter if you're trying to help someone else. You're not going to be able to do so.
Right.
And basically, that's the way things continue here. You know, at the beginning of this minute, we see... You know, the different the check-in counters, and we see people just running out of the lobby to try to get as quickly as possible outside of the airport because this is an airport that's been taken over by terrorists, even though none of them knew that beforehand. you know, they weren't affected by it at all.
Right.
And so, but hey, if the guy on TV says there's a problem, we got to get out of here. And we get
a nice little moment with the camera as it's kind of, and it's obviously a low but still crane shot because it's kind of pulling up and to the right. It does end with just to the right of frame. It lets you know they must be running for the exits because the gates are actually the to the left. This shows you a little the sign that says, hey, if you want to go to your gate to pick up your plane, it's this way. And they're all running, obviously, away from camera.
That is so cool that you and I are in tune because I was just about to talk about that. No, which is great. That's great. Because we also then get to see a number of flights that are on the board. You know, we don't get to see the full data on all these flights. But what's interesting is these are not flights that we saw beforehand. You know, they give us different ones. We have, you know, Seattle, Mexico, Tel, I'm assuming it means Tel Aviv, Tokyo, London, Helsinki, a whole bunch of different flights that are listed here. Of course, the one to Tel Aviv is 666. You know, yeah, I don't know what the connection is there, but it's also the same airline as the one that goes to Seattle, which is a little strange also, but okay. You know, there's no way of us knowing what airline these are. It's very possible that in most movies, the person who set this up, they probably use like initials of people they know. You know, you have like GM, FF.
Yeah, WS.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, people I know. I wonder if I were to go and look at the production manager to see if those are their names. That could also be. You know, a lot of times I know in the original Die Hard, they actually did that. You know, we had the crew and stuff like that listed. The construction crew were listed. There was like a sign about the construction sign. And therefore, you know, they were using the names of the people there. Mm-hmm. So it would be very interesting to see if they actually did that here. What is that? That's like the set decorators and stuff like that, you think?
Set decorators, okay. It could be production design. Actually, it starts with production designers and then down to the actual set decoration. But yeah, could be anybody within that group.
Yeah, okay. Well, none of those people are listed here because the production designer is John Villone.
Decorating the set.
Right. Production designer is John Villone. The art director is Christian Wagner. Set director is Robert Gould. Marilyn Vance is the costume designer. So maybe it was people on the team itself. You know, if we go deeper into the different departments, maybe to try and find out the different people here. But we're not going to spend that time on that.
Really? What are we going to spend time on then, Rob?
Don't worry. We always have things to talk about. Oh, has there ever been a point, Alan, where you and I do not have what to talk about?
No, in fact, I think I've said this before. I've even stopped trying to figure out what I should probably pre-research because I have no idea what triggers you to go look up some interesting factoid.
Well, just wait. We have some fun ones for this minute, too. Don't worry.
All right.
You know, I will not disappoint. How's that? And as we see the people running out, then we see a shot of three small TV sets. You know, which one of them says TV, the other one says Surveillance 1, and the other one Surveillance 2. And we can actually see on the first one, you have Thornburg's picture superimposed over the stolen weather map. And then the other two are just pictures of people that are, you know, running out of the airport. And then we hear Trudeau's voice, and he goes, "That stupid, arrogant son of a bitch. It's all over the airport."
I'm glad he's got a reputation among everybody, including the upper echelon of airport management.
It means nobody likes him, but the truth is the fact that everybody knows who he is already says something about him. Also, he's, you know, he might have a bad reputation, but you know what's the phrase? Even bad publicity is good publicity.
Or yeah, any there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Exactly. So, like, okay, everyone knows that Thornburg is an ass. That's fine. You know, people don't like him, but they're still watching him. They still know.
They still know of him, exactly.
Exactly. He still has this Geraldo type of show that people are tuning into because if if people weren't tuning in, they would have canceled them a long time ago. You know, I guess that goes with reality TV. I mean, obviously, reality TV has changed a lot in the 33 years since this movie came out. But, you know, we can see what direction it's going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people love, watching other people's problems.
Well, it's the old Don Henley song, Dirty Laundry.
That's right. That's very true. And then we get the great shot of his face. And we see Thornburg's face superimposed, you know, on the screen as we continue to hear him talking. And he goes, 300 people have died. Now, that's really strange that he would have that amount of information. You know, they never told us how many people were on the Windsor Air flight. But my assumption is it did not look like it was a plane that would have 300 people on it.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to remember back through the script, but even if it was full, you assume the holidays, it's going to be full.
No, but that's a plane. It was a plane that only had two sides. You know, there was no middle row. So you have three on each side. So that's six people in a row. I mean, I don't think that you know, I don't think that the plane has 50 rows. Maybe.
I don't know. What kind of plane was it?
That I don't remember. You got me on that one. I'll have to go back and look that up. But my assumption is there were not 300 people on that plane. Even if it was full. It looked like a smaller plane.
Okay. Let's say a smaller, maybe like a 737.
Could be.
Six seats per row, which is what you just described.
Okay.
And I think that would give you like 32 rows. So 6 times 32.
6 times 32 only comes out to like 180. 189.
Okay. So maybe with crew and maybe if you include first class, maybe over 200, but certainly feels
not
like,
300.
It does, like 300 is a little exaggerated. Maybe the hyperbole from a known hyperbolist.
Yes. Here, the from what I can see here, the maximum number of people you can fit on a 737 is 215 passengers. So again, it still doesn't reach the 300. You know, but again, if he's trying to instill panic here, or I mean, he's inadvertently trying to instill panic. But I mean, his point is to let everyone know about the fear that's going on. So. You know, you can exaggerate a little bit, I guess, even especially if you're Dick Thornburg, you're going to be exaggerating about everything. So who knows? And then did you notice that above the little screen that Trudeau was looking at, there's like a diagram of all of the different dials, which is very strange. Did you see what I'm talking about? OK, so it's at the 3 second mark or 2 second mark.
Oh, you're going all the way back.
I'm going back a little bit. I'm going back a little bit. It shows like the different frequencies. Oh. We can see Dulles departure control number. And what other ones can you actually read? Most of them you can't read them.
Right. I see the schematic. Yeah. Just above the monitors.
Yeah. It's a very strange schematic showing, you know, like the different frequencies that you can use to tune into things. You know, I wonder how they knew how to get onto the TV, the TV station.
Yeah. I'm wondering if that's the frequency for each of the cameras. No, that can't be that.
I don't think so.
It's so hard to, because the camera pans. When it pans, you get motion blur.
Yeah.
And you can't really see or read anything except for just that one moment when it's a still. Because as soon as it starts to move, it's too blurred to see.
Yeah. Oh, well. and then we're back to the plane itself, right after hearing Thornburg talk, and you know the way that his face is superimposed on the screen, it like pans to the left, and we get to see people arguing with the stewardess. We basically get to see the old woman who was sitting next to Holly, and she's complaining. And she goes, "When are we going to land?" And the stewardess says, "I have no information." And then we continue to hear the voice of Thornburg on TV, and he goes, "And unfortunately, they may not be the last. The horrifying fact is that no one is safe, either in the planes above Dulles or in the terminal below. The threat of a new and higher body count at the airport hangs over the heads of everyone, and the holiday season of peace and love has become a nightmare." I mean, he's
he's such a hyperbole, and he's like stoking fear with his exaggerated use of language. I mean, that's right. Just him.
That's right. I mean, I gotta say, it is a great speech. I mean, if you don't think about what exactly, you know, he's doing by saying it, but I mean, this guy does have a way with words. He is causing too much panic with it, but you know what he's saying sort of makes sense. I mean, mm-hmm. we know he's exaggerating, but everyone listening to him do not. They don't know that.
Right. Well, because plus he tries to use almost literary kind of expressions. You know, remember mm-hmm. in the first one where he started talking about, and now our city has joined that sad fraternity of those who have been terrorized. You know, like,
that's
who
right.
uses, like, who talks that's about right. that? Like, sad fraternity.
That's right. Only people like Thornburg.
Exactly.
Right. And as the camera pans, we eventually see Holly, who's sitting, you know, in her seat, and she's looking up and she sees Thornburg on the TV, or at least she sees his picture on the TV. And then she picks up the headphones next to her, which I assume are the headphones of the woman who's sitting next to her, and starts to continue to listen to what he's saying. And then there she hears, you know, this diatribe, and you see her face and her eyes darting back and forth, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what it is that he's doing. And at the end, she, like, we see like a jump from her, you know, that she's mm-hmm. scared, realizing what it is that he now is doing. You know, so Bonnie Bedelia does a great job here of just by giving us the look on her face. You know, we know that her
emoting with facial expression really goes along, because, you know, likely there's nobody even acting off of her. They were just saying, okay, and you're hearing him and react. Like, she sells it all with obviously nothing really being said from Thornburg on set.
Correct.
She's just having to emote everything.
That's right, for sure. And then we see her eyes look down, and we see the purse of the old lady sitting next to her. And then we see her stick her hand into the purse and mm-hmm. take out a, you know, a wallet with a wad of bills. No, I'm kidding.
No.
And she takes out a zapper or a taser, or there's so many different names for this contraption that we talked about months ago with what she had here. But it got me thinking about the fact that, you know, she's basically stealing this, you know. Like, so I started thinking, like, what is it called for someone to be able to steal like this? Do you have any idea? You know, like professionals that are stealing, that are robbing people. Do you know of a name for this type of thing of what people do?
Oh, like in this case, you're, well, technically, because the woman's not there, but pickpocketing. I mean, then that's what I'm thinking of right here. When you're going into someone's purse and you're trying to pick their pocket or pick their purse.
Right. Okay, I mean, that is true. That's not where I was thinking. I was thinking more that it's known as a snatch theft.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sudden where, snatching.
That's right. Where, you know, you see this a lot in movies dealing with like Vietnam or you know, places in the Far East, or maybe down in South America and stuff like that, where you'll have like two people riding on a motorcycle or a moped. And then, you know, the second guy will go and grab a purse or something like that. I'm assuming you've seen the movie Full Metal Jacket.
Yes.
Where that happens, where, you know, the guy drives by on a moped and grabs a camera from Rafterman. Mm-hmm. You know, that type of thing. So it's basically the idea of forcefully stealing someone's personal property by employing rob and run tactics. Okay, which obviously I know that this isn't what Holly's doing, but you know, she is, you know, she's doing something for the right, because we know what she's about to do, but to go into someone else's bag, you know, if she were to get caught here, she in this situation, she might be able to get herself out of it as to the fact that she's not doing anything wrong, but it is somewhat, you can classify it as stealing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine if the old woman were to be like, "What are you doing?" It's like, "We've got a problem in the bathroom. Hold on." And the woman's like, "Oh, okay."
That's right.
I mean, they were friends sitting down talking, and the old woman voluntarily told her about it, you know, months ago.
Yes. That's true. And I mean, I got lists of all these different countries where snatch theft is a very big crime, where it happens quite often. So the country that, according to this article that I found, that has the most of these snatch thefts is the Philippines. How many cases of snatch theft do you think occur in the Philippines on average in a given year?
Oh, in a year, not 10,000.
No, only 3,000. But still, that's still a hell of a lot. That's a hell of a lot.
3,000 a year.
Yes.
So that's on average 10, about 8 to 10 a day, I would say.
Something like that. That happens a lot. Of course,
the Philippines is not a very big place, but it's populated, so.
Correct. And one of the things that they actually tried passing a law there that didn't pass in the end, that motorcycles can only be ridden by one person in order to try and stop these.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. So you can't give somebody a ride on your motorcycle.
No. The bill didn't pass in the end, but someone tried. No. Someone tried making a bill about that. It'd be like, I'd take you for a ride, but I'm not allowed to because they might think that I'm going to steal someone's, purse along the way. Yeah, I don't know. So yes. So Holly steals only the zapper, and she's holding it in her hand, and then the shot changes, and once again this week they decide to shock us with something, and they have someone fly through burst through a glass window, because it's not a Die Hard movie without broken glass,
and gotta have broken glass.
And you gotta have as much as you can. And they do that here also, and you can actually even see that there are airline crew members in the crowd also. You see someone that's dressed like a captain that's in the rush, and then we see another glass door break down and people fall on the ground and people just run over them. No one really cares.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, why not? We'll just stampede over them.
That's the problem with any kind of a crowd that stampedes and gets up against gates or barriers, because the people behind them don't know there's people on the ground and they get trampled to death. They literally,
right.
People will die just because fellow human beings are stomping on them trying to get out in a panic.
Yeah.
What I do,
unfortunately, happens too often.
What I enjoy seeing is the stunt people are purposely dressed up with a gear all over, like they've got stuff to cover. I mean, obviously it's winter anyway, you would be wearing, but they've got stuff to cover their hands and their face as they go down. So any of the breakaway glass, they're kind of protected. And if you notice, they pretty much go heads down and cover their faces. So that way any broken glass that's coming down doesn't get in their face.
Right. Well, come on. These are professionals.
Of course they are. And the slow-mo, the choice of going slow-mo on this is great, because then you can see the glass just shattering. It's obviously not safety glass like you would expect you would have in any kind of a public building.
Correct. Correct. And then the shot takes us outside, and we see Lorenzo running towards a police car, but there are just masses all around him, and we can actually even see John there. And then we hear Lorenzo start talking, and he goes, "All right, listen up. All units, I want your conversion, hangar 11, all sides." And then he turns to McClane and goes, "This car, McClane, get in." Mm-hmm. Now, how is everyone even supposed to hear him with everyone screaming like this?
Well, we can hear him just fine, so.
We can, because he's got a mic on him, but all the other cops are going to have a little bit more of a problem doing that.
This is something that, and it's a good point. You learn in the military, and similarly in any kind of a law enforcement, to learn how to project your voice. I'm not suggesting that the actor is doing a good job of showing the projection, but you can bellow your voice without hurting your vocal cords if you learn how. And it's entirely possible when you're used to giving command that when you're belting it and you're intentionally using your diaphragm to shove that volume through your voice, when there's a lot of noise and you're trying to like yell over the cacophony of the battle, you develop a technique where you can use your diaphragm to really put a lot of energy behind your voice so you can be heard. So you're not screaming from your throat, which could hurt your throat, but you're literally bringing it from down deep, and it can go a lot further because it's got more power behind it.
Right. And, I guess Lorenzo's that type of guy, even if, Sipowicz himself can't do it.
Right. Right. The guy in charge, you were supposed to think everyone can hear him, even though his vocal range here is way up in his throat. He's not bellowing it from below to be able to be heard over that sound. He's just yelling, but it works for the movie. But I think in terms, if it were a real life situation, that could be a problem if you had somebody who didn't know how to project their voice over that crowd noise.
Correct. Now, I do love the timing of the way they do this in the script here, that, it's happening at the exact moment that all the cops are going towards their cars. That obviously is movie timing, but it still works.
Mm-hmm.
And then he motions to John which car to get into as they're like trying to wade through this crowd. And then John gets into the car. And we're going to have a little surprise for John coming up. And they do it really nicely because they show John get in on the left-hand side. And then they show us Lorenzo getting in on the right-hand side. And Lorenzo screams, "When the City Blue show up with their backup, they'll pick up the pieces. Now move out." And like he motions his hand like we normally see like in a, when someone's doing a cattle drive, move out.
Mm-hmm.
That type of thing.
Roll out. Autobots, roll out.
That's right. Exactly. And then, they get into the car and again, they do this is a great shot because we see Lorenzo's face. And Lorenzo turns to John and goes, "McLean, say hi to my brother Vito." And we don't see his face right now. Then we see John, and then John looks over to his right to see who it is. And then we get Robert Costanza's face right in front of him. And he goes,
"It is so big on the screen."
That's right. And he goes, "Merry Christmas."
And then ends with that kind of a snarky
smile. Grin. That's right.
Yeah.
Because it's nice to see that Vito actually recognizes John. It means that there's nothing really interesting that's been going on during his shift. No planes have blown up, and there were no punks that were getting capped in the luggage area. Nothing interesting has happened. He's gone through a very boring shift, so therefore he's obviously going to remember the face of a guy whose car got towed at the beginning of the, just a few hours ago.
Right.
Yeah. It makes perfect sense.
I tell you, the responding reaction to seeing this guy's face is so funny from McLean. He's just like, okay.
And he goes, "Hi." that's his response. He gives him a little bit of a hi.
But just, he's kind of got that slack jawed, like, "You gotta be kidding me." It's great.
Yes. It really is. They do it really well.
Yeah. Bruce because, Willis, I know he got pigeonholed early on as either just a cheap TV comedian, and then Die Hard really put him on the map as an action character, but he's a very good actor, and he can do a lot with just a little bit.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. I think he can, and he does. But part of the problem is that the roles that he chose to take later in his career were mostly just working on this persona of him being able to do Die Hard type roles. Yeah. I think he could have been a much more dramatic actor had he taken those kind of roles. We talked about it, the first week that you were on about some of your favorite movies of his, and a lot of people have talked about, ever since, telling us their favorite Bruce Willis roles. And if you look at it, during the 90s, he had some very dramatic roles that he took on that it's shocking that he didn't try and move forward with those and somehow just move back into the action realm. I mean, come on, you had films like The Sixth Sense and Pulp Fiction. What else can you Unbreakable?
Unbreakable, Sixth Sense.
12 Monkeys fits in there also. There's a whole bunch of movies that he did that were more there were less John McClane type roles. And, you know, it's unfortunate that he wasn't able to move forward with that and do some better dramatic type roles. Not that I'm saying I don't like him in his you know, John McClane persona. I think some of his best movies are in that persona. But
what I think shows his potential is you get a quote an A-list actor in terms of a box office draw, and then you're kind of pigeonholed by the industry that if you don't make, you know, a bajillion dollars with every movie, then you must have failed somehow. Because you're used to being associated with these big blockbusters, and the smaller, more dramatic, you know, more meaty roles sometimes don't net that kind of take at the box office. And unfortunately, actors that get kind of pigeonholed as action stars, the movie might do well. It might even make money as a small film, but Bruce Willis's latest movie only made $100 million. You know, you're like, what?
That's right.
You know. they spent 20 making it. Of course, it's a good movie, but it wasn't the $300 million blockbuster that we're used to seeing, or the $500 million, or whatever it is now. So I think that happens sometimes. I think he just got put in that kind of that bucket that if you're not making, you know, tentpole kind of movies, then you're not doing anything worthwhile.
Right. Okay, I can hear that. You know, I don't necessarily agree with it, but I can understand it.
Oh, yeah. I don't agree with it either. I just think that happens to some actors. I think that's what happens to like the Sylvester Stallones, the Arnold Schwarzeneggers. They were so used to being just big, boisterous, big box office that whenever they would try to do something that's not typical, it could be fantastic, and they just gets rejected. I mean, I think one of the funnier movies and one of the just better movies Sylvester Stallone did was a movie called Oscar, which is almost like a play on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't do well at all in the theater because they're like, oh, we don't have guns and car chases and damsels in distress. Like, well, that's not that kind of movie.
Right. Right. I think also one of the problems that these action stars were used to getting very high salaries, and the dramatic movies, you know, just don't have the budget for that. You need to have an action film that will have a budget that they can pay, you know, Bruce Willis $20 million or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a problem also. I mean, they need to be willing to forego that large salary in order to do something a little more prolific, you know, which sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But, you know, they got to feed their kids. So how can people survive not getting $20 million for 4 months of work? I don't know. You know. If I ever find out, I will let you know. So that's pretty much everything I have for this minute. Did you have anything else for this minute?
No. It's one of those, you know, the last couple of minutes have been so much just crowd and looking at just this chaos, which is kind of nice because this movie does bounce back and forth from quiet to menace to chaos and loud and then back. And it weaves that pretty darn well throughout the whole film. So you never feel like you're always in noise or you're always in tension. And there's those moments of comic relief. It as a sequel to Die Hard, it is a pretty darn good companion piece. I know a lot of people said, oh, it wasn't as good as the original. It's so hard to be better than the first thing that took everyone, you know, by storm, but it's still a worthwhile film. I do think the third one is a little better than the second. So I get, you know, that kind of like the ebbs and flows that people like in one movie versus another. But as a Die Hard movie, this is really good.
Yes. Yeah. Because also this is, you know, he's doing things on his own here still. In the next one, which again, I also love, you know, then he has Samuel L. Jackson with him the whole time. So it's a team. It's a team effort.
Which I like because had they tried to do a solo one again, I don't know. It may have actually been worse. I like the idea of you got to do something a little different with John McClane. Let's do the kind of buddy cop situation, but in this case it's not another cop, and they're actually set almost as foils to each other initially, and then they have to learn to work together, which is fun to watch that dynamic over the course of the film.
Oh yeah, for sure. I completely agree with you on that. But that's, you see, that's the whole thing, that, you know, you have the idea of a Die Hard type of movie, and then, you know, you have the main character, and like you said, you need to change it a little bit each time, because if it's just a carbon copy of the previous movie, then no one's going to care. You know, which is I think where they went wrong on the fifth one, because they wanted to really do things differently, and then they took everything out of the, you know, Die Hard type of storyline because it was just too much.
Right. For me, it stops at the trilogy. I mean, I've seen Die Hard 4, and I think I've seen once the fifth Die Hard. I'm trying to remember because it did not make an impact at all. For me, there's no reason to go watch 4 or 5. I just like watching 1, 2, and 3. And I'll set it aside. Like my wife and I do this with some of our favorite series or trilogies. We'll have weekends that we just say, okay, it's time for a return to this binge. And we'll go watch, you know, we'll do all the Harry Potter. We'll do the Back to the Future. We'll do the Raiders of the Lost Ark, but only 1, 2, and 3. You know, we'll do Die Hard 1, 2, and 3. You know, that's to me, that's the trilogy.
Correct. Okay, but I know that in a few seasons from now, I will eventually get you to rewatch 4 and maybe even 5. We'll see.
Oh, I mean, I will put myself through whatever's necessary to be able to be part of your program. So don't worry about that. I may not revere it like I'm doing 1, 2, and 3, but I'll still be more than happy to be here.
Oh, I won't. I won't either. But you know, that's part of my problem with 5. You know, that the. You know, I know that 4 is tolerable. It's got a lot of fun things in it. You know, it'll be a fun movie to do minute by minute when I get to it in 4 seasons from now. But I don't know what I'm gonna do with 5. I think as I've stated numerous times, as of now, my idea for 5 is maybe just like a one episode thing with one or two guests, just maybe doing like a commentary as the movie goes along or something. I don't know. We'll have to. I have a number of seasons till I get there, so I'm fine right now.
All right. You need to shake up your own show format so that you can keep growing your audience, right?
Yeah, of course, of course. Definitely. All right. So the script, it's actually interesting the way that the script describes everything that's going on here. So it starts off the front of the terminal, a mass exodus, people fight for cabs. We move into the control tower. They're watching this here too. Christ, that fucking asshole. That's what Trudeau says in the script. You know,
I like that.
As opposed to that stupid, arrogant son of a bitch. I think stupid, arrogant son of a bitch works a little better coming from Trudeau. But it's just very funny that that's the way they do it in the script. And then it shows the rear of the terminal, airport police parking lot. McLean is in Lorenzo's police car, a dozen other police cars full of officers behind, lights spinning. Lorenzo leans out the window like Ward Bond on Wagon Train. Converge on Hangar 11 on all 4 sides. When the city blues get here with the backup, they can pick up the pieces. Move out. McLean, you meet my nephew? The other guy in the car is the who towed the car. As McLean reacts, the caravan roars forward, sirens wailing. So, you know, I like the fact that in the movie, the police cars are in a position where they can't really move because, you know, they have too many people running around them. In the script, it sounds as if there's nobody around them. So,
you know, I like the chaos of everything. I mean, even in the script, the chaos was kind of more in the bar. Remember, there was just kind of like the lounge based on the script. It's much more impactful when it's the whole airport, even though it makes no sense that everyone at the airport's listening to the exact same thing at the same time visually. And then orally, when you start hearing all that noise and the people screaming and yelling, it makes a much more chaotic impact in what's happening in the film. So I think the direction that Renny Harlin took it, I think to make it bigger than the script, was a good choice.
Yeah, for sure. And then the script continues and it goes into stuff that we're going to talk about next week. But then it jumps back to things that we see in this minute. So it says interior of Holly's airplane. Widened from the TV screen, Thornburg's broadcast is here too. A woman screams. A man tries to get out of a seat, and a stewardess forces him back. Holly realizes what's going and says, "My God." Then something else sinks in. She looks at the empty airphone cradle on the wall, gets quickly out of her seat. In mid-stride, she stops, takes her seatmate's purse. Then she sidesteps some panicked people, goes to the kitchen area, and finds one of the special keys for the laboratories. So it's a little different. You know, in the script, they don't reveal the fact that she's taking out the taser to eventually take on Thornburg. And, you know, the fact that they say that she found the special key to the bathroom is very interesting also.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's what we got from the script. So, Alan, once again, I want to thank you for stepping up this week and rejoining us. And I had a great time this week. Is there anything else you want to say about Die Hard 2 in general? Is there anything that you have that maybe you didn't get a chance to say in all of the episodes you've been in?
No, I just it, I rem okay, I can I'm trying to remember back. I don't think I said this, but when I saw Die Hard 2 originally in the theater, I saw Die Hard 1 in the theater, fell in love with it, became one of my all-time favorite movies. It's a movie I watch every Christmas. We talked about that when you did that season. When Die Hard 2 came out, for some reason, I was let down in the theater on my first watching. I remember being, the rug pulled out from under me a couple of times, as we've talked about in this one past, in this week we've just gone through, but I remember saying, oh, it's not as good as the first one. And I felt let down because I think I had such high expectations because I didn't know what to expect in the first movie. And I was completely taken off guard. I just was blown away as the movie just continued to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I was just sucked into it. And I think I walked into Die Hard 2 in the movie theater going, it's going to need to be at least as big. And I didn't give it its due in the movie theater. Plus, I was a lot younger. And on subsequent rewatchings, I have really, as I said earlier, I've really come to enjoy what Rennie Harlan did to try to make this a Die Hard movie with a completely different backdrop setting, a different premise for the background. I like it a lot more now than when I first saw it. And it's one of those things that's not because it was bad. I think I just put unrealistic expectations the first time I watched it.
Right. That's one of the problems with, with a lot of movies that if you don't see them at the right time, there's just too much hype for them. Like I have a friend that it took him, I think, at least 10 years, if not more, to finally see Shawshank because he said that it'll never live up to the expectations that everyone had, had given of it. And then when he saw it, he wasn't overwhelmed by it because he had such high expectations that he wasn't able to even reach that. So, it's a problem. Which is why we all try to go into movies without expectations, whether they're good or bad. But sometimes you don't have control over that. You just gonna feel that, okay, is this gonna, this is a sequel to this movie. Like I'll give you a perfect example. The Dial of Destiny, which came out just a few months ago. I know that you and I talked about this. I went to see it and I was really hoping that they would get back to what they had in the first trilogy of Indiana Jones. And the first 20 minutes, it seemed as if they were on that track, and it was great. And then they just lost it. And then, all that all the hype that I built up in me, hoping that they would get to there, made it even more disappointing because they didn't. That type of thing.
And that's why I think, as a general commentary on films today, especially with the prevalence of seeing so much on social media and they push so much marketing, I try, if there's a film that catches my interest, I actually don't go look for trailers. I try to not read articles. I don't want to know what anyone's thought about it from a pre-screening or what they're hearing on Hollywood Insiders, because I've had too many movies that my first watching wasn't nearly as good as it could have been because I had unrealistic or expectations set for me that were not close to what I would have gotten had I just gone to see the movie. And
Correct.
it's taken sometimes movies for me, because I'll recognize a well-made movie even if I wasn't impacted by it. If I walk out going, well, it was all right, I'll realize, okay, that was a well-made movie. I'm going to go back and watch it again after I've given it some time. And more often than not, those movies end up being much better the second and third watchings. And it's only because I allowed outside forces to manipulate how I was going to approach the first time watch.
Right. I agree. I mean, I'm also someone who tries to avoid watching trailers. If I'll watch a trailer to a movie, it'll be like months beforehand, so that by the time I see the movie, I will have forgotten some of the, little aspects of it. I know that a few weeks ago, my wife was interested in seeing a certain movie at home, not even, and she wanted to watch the trailer first. So we watched the trailer. And then when we watched the movie, there was something that they told us in the trailer that you only find out at half an hour through the movie. And I was like, I can't believe they ruined this. It would have been so much more enjoyable to find this out as the story moved along instead of, the 3-minute trailer already telling us this particular tidbit. So I try to avoid it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
And I get you've got people behind the scenes that say, well, we've got to tease the audience. We need them to all show up. We want to get them excited. And there's a fine line between getting you excited and giving you just enough to whet your appetite versus screwing up the movie or giving away all the comedic bits. Comedies are the worst for that. They try to show you all the funniest things in the trailer, and you go see the movie and you go, I already saw all the funniest bits of this movie. Nothing else is as funny as in the trailer. Why'd you do that? And that's because right. They need
except,
you to get you.
Except you get to see them. You get to see them in the movie in context. That's the only difference. You know, or, yeah. It might be a little bit funnier because they're in context as opposed to out of context, but you know, still doesn't. But you're right. Most of the best jokes they use in the trailers. And I've never understood that.
I'll just say, as my piece of advice for movie watchers, especially people who listen to podcasts like this where we're breaking movies down, don't go reading and don't go watching everything ahead of time. You'll get a much better – trust yourself to be told the story. It's like the Christopher Nolan view of I want my audience to have to think about what they're watching. I trust my audience to be smart enough to figure things out. I want them to come and have an experience. I don't want them to know everything when they walk in the front door. That's the whole point of sitting down to a movie going, okay, what am I about to experience? What am I about to see? And I so much appreciate movies now when I don't know anything about them besides maybe a rough idea of what maybe genre they fit in or maybe who's in it. But it makes it such a more, so much more of an enjoyable experience on a first time watch.
I completely agree with you on that. All right. Well, Alan, once again, thank you very much for joining me this week and a week many, many months ago. I always have fun talking to you. Hopefully all the listeners enjoy our side conversations along the way also and have garnered some type of, you know, fun information and tidbits about this movie. So thank you again for joining me.
Well, as always, thank you for inviting me. I'm always ready to talk about movies with you anytime and all the other stuff we end up talking about along the way. But I, you know, anytime you need, whatever seasons you've got, I know you've got already a Christmas themed one coming up. So I'm really looking forward to being part of that and whatever else you need, buddy. Cause I love talking movies.
All right. I appreciate that. So we want to once again, tell people where they can find Alan Sanders.
All right. If you like doing the movie breakdown, like what we do here with the movie Rob Minute, well, you can go find The Wilder Ride. My buddy Walt Murray and I did Gene Wilder movies. We did two of them. We did Young Frankenstein, and then we did Blazing Saddles seasons 1 and 2. And then when the whole world caught the flu, we had to back off and change our format. So we ended up doing more of a talk show via Zoom. Still pretty relevant. Still got some cool guests and some pretty funny moments in there. Well worth checking out. And then if you like more of the news talk of the day, I do a political podcast. It's a daily show. It's through my headquarters radio affiliated station, WSB in Atlanta, but it goes on every podcatcher, and it's The Alan Sanders Show. Everything is available at your podcatcher of choice.
All right, great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, moverobminute.com. So I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, have a great weekend and yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here